mechanics. I was filling up gas, about to get on the highway to go to St. Catharines. I look down at my wheel, and it's completely flat, flat as the prairies. I realize I got a problem on my way to St. Catharines, so I have to immediately find a place to go, find a place, and they're like, yeah, you got a problem. Now, the thing about mechanics is I don't have a clue what's going on with cars, so they could take me to town if they wanted to. So the mechanic said, hey, I'm going to take a look, and let's hope we can save your tire. Now, he ended up being able to save it. He patched it, repaired it, so I was lucky for that, but he could have told me I needed 4 new tires. I would have taken them. I didn't know what was going on. And then this week, I had a real problem because the car was making a noise, and then the engine light went on. And that was really terrifying because the engine light, that's just like, okay, big trouble. So where's Doug? I took my car to Doug. There he is, Doug the mechanic there. Great guy, great, honest guy. But I took my car into him. He said, what's the problem? I said, it's making a noise. And it's always weird trying to explain to mechanics what's wrong with your car. He's like, well, what sort of noise? And I'm like, well, kind of like, you know, and it's just, and, you know, I can see him looking at me like, well, this guy's an idiot. But so he takes a look at the car, and, you know, I said, maybe it's the ball bearings. That's always my go-to. I don't really know what. I'm like, it could be the ball bearings, maybe. I don't know. So he takes a look at it. He gives me a call. He says, well, you know, there's some issues here with the Johnson rod. And no, that's a made-up thing. There's no such thing as a Johnson rod. But he's telling me in a language, and this is not good, because when I tell stories, mostly people can't confirm or deny. So, Doug, this is the paraphrase I heard. He's like, there's a problem with the thingy, and you could probably leave the thingy for a little bit, but if you leave the thingy and it eventually falls off, flames are going to come out the back of your car. That's what I heard. So I thought, you know, Kristen drives the car more than I thought I'd better get it fixed. But one of the things that I find with mechanics is just at their mercy, you hope that they're good and honest people because you have no idea what's going on. Or it's someone like me, what's going on under the hood. And thankfully, Doug's a great guy. So we got it all fixed up. It's ready to purr for another 2 years until I get my Tesla Cybertruck. That's right. Anyway, now I don't have a clue about car engines, but what I want to do this morning is I want to do some sleuthing work under the hood of another sort of engine. And last week we started the series Beyond Enemies, and what I want to do this morning is try to get under the hood, under the engine of this machine, see how it works, because my hope is if we can understand how the engine of the enemy-making machine works, then perhaps we can come to understand how to free ourselves from its influence. So let me start with this question. How do distinctives arise with any group, whether that be a church or another group? Because every church or group gathers around certain common held beliefs or values or practices. We have ours here at Nexus. Other groups do. Other churches do. There are usually things that hold the group together. But with any group or church, there are also distinctives that make a specific community different from each other. And distinctives are what have given the church over 30,000 denominations over the last few centuries. There's distinctions with all of them. And we see this play out all throughout church history, but the biggest distinction starts with the Protestant Reformation. And what happens to the Protestant Reformation, again, we talked a little bit about it last week, but the Catholic Church is so corrupt in the medieval ages that what they were doing is they were selling these things called indulgences. And what that meant is if a person died and was presumed they were in purgatory, you could, for a small fee, pay the priest, and their punishment in purgatory would be a little less severe. Keep paying for indulgences, and, you know, maybe eventually they get their way out of purgatory, which is awful, right? I mean, can you imagine grieving about losing a loved one and then thinking, oh, no, I bet you they're in purgatory. I guess I got to come up with some cash to ease their burden. I mean, it's an awful thing. And so Martin Luther shows up and says this is absurd. He's got a distinctive, and his distinctive is this: justification by faith alone. You don't need to pay God or a priest to ease someone's burden or suffering. And, of course, Luther wanted to reform the Catholic Church, but they wouldn't listen to him, so he goes off and he starts his own little brand of church. And its distinction was justification by faith alone. Fair enough, in that day, that distinction is completely necessary. And I've come to think this, distinctives are often necessary in times of crisis or when a community is struggling or when change is desperately needed. And this is the intriguing thing to me. Most distinctives start out of necessity. Like, consider the temperance movement. I grew up in a church that was in the late stages of the temperance movement. And for reasons that were unclear to me at the time, alcohol was strictly forbidden in my faith upbringing. Now, in my recollection, there was never really a clear rationale given for that. It was just taboo. Christians don't drink. At least our brand doesn't. And the interesting thing to me is when you go back, look into history, it actually started as a bit of a necessity. You see, alcoholism was rampant in the 18th, 19th centuries in Britain and the U.S., and realizing there was this very real toll that alcoholism was playing, it was ruining lives, tearing apart families, temperance movement, often led by women, I might add, and churches started emphasizing no alcohol. We must be delivered from the tolls of alcohol problems. This is a temperance movement poster, I guess you could say. Next slide. There it is. Okay. Oh, you're going to have a hard time reading that. I'm having a hard time reading that. There we go. This I love. Step one, a glass with a friend. That's how it starts. And then step two, a glass to keep the cold out. Step three, a glass too much. Step four, drunk and riotous. Step five, what does that say? The summit attained, jolly companions, a confirmed drunkard. But then step six, poverty and disease. Like, that seems like a quick step down there. And forsaken by friends, desperation and crime, and then death by suicide. Like, that's like, whoa. And it's fascinating to me because this sort of strikes us as like, what in the world? But at the time, this stuff was happening. And for people in my faith upbringing, a lot of people had these stories. I know my mother, she was adopted and raised in an abusive home where her father drank and consistently beat my mom's mom. And so for her, this made sense. And then my dad always told the story of partying one night with friends and, like, literally a Tommy boy. He just collapsed on a coffee table and got up and was like, I gotta change my life. Or I remember one time the pastor of our church, a visiting pastor, and he tells the story of waking up in a dumpster after a night of alcohol and realizing something had to change. And these stories were not uncommon. And it started out that abstaining from alcohol actually helped a lot of people's lives. And it still does. I was just meeting with some old friends, two of them recovering alcoholics. The stories they tell are just mind-boggling. Waking up in ditches, drinking 26er for breakfast, like just out of control. So the thing to me is this, distinctives are often good and necessary things. A community says, we got a problem here. And they often emerge as a necessary solution to a real problem, a real challenge, whether it's justification by faith alone, being affirming, abstinence beliefs, temperance beliefs, many of these start from a good, necessary place. But when you get under the hood of the enemy-making machine, what you start to notice is that distinctives often form the basis for enemy-making. Because the progression often works this way. This distinction has made us better people. This distinction has solved the problem for us. Therefore, if all people adopted our distinctive, they would be better people as well. And suddenly, what makes sense to a particular group of people, perhaps in a community, it gets universalized. What is right, good, true, helpful for us in this context should be for everyone. And suddenly, a distinctive becomes divorced from context And for some people, some communities, yes, discerning what's happening together among them, they might say this is a collective decision we make, but it takes on a bigger life. The conviction from "I will not drink alcohol" becomes so central to a group's identity that they now begin to identify, you know who's in and out of our group? If you drink, you're out. If you don't, you're in, because this is part of our identity. So something that starts in a good place suddenly ends up creating an us versus them mentality. It gives us enemies. This was the case in our church. I think a lot of people growing up in the church I grew up in, they didn't know why we didn't drink alcohol. We just knew if you did, that was bad. And I think this happens all the time to churches and other groups. And so the question for me has become this: when you know this is happening, are there signs, are there tells, you could say, are there giveaways that the enemy-making machine has been triggered with people, with a group? And it's fascinating because I think Scripture actually gives us two really interesting examples of the way that the enemy-making machine can start to work. The first is what cultural theorists call master signifiers or bannerism. Underneath this banner, and we see this at work in the Corinthian church with Paul. He's writing to the Corinthian church. I'm going to read it, and I'm going to unpack it for you because there's a bit of strange language here. But Paul says to this church, "Brothers and sisters, I could not address you as people who live by the Spirit, but as people who are still worldly, mere infants in Christ. I gave you milk, not solid food, for you were not ready for it. Indeed, you're still not ready. You are still worldly. For since there's jealousy and quarreling among you, are you not worldly? Are you not acting like mere humans? For one says, 'I follow Paul,' and another, 'I follow Apollos.' Are you not mere human beings?" And it sort of sounds like when you read that, that Paul's sort of suggesting that being merely human is a problem, but it's quite the opposite, actually. I think I've mentioned to you this before. The book of 1 Corinthians is probably my favorite book because the church was a hot mess. Like, just, they had so many problems. And so many people are like, "The early church was great." I'm like, well, not this one. They just had so many conflict and divisions, and so it gives me hope. Because if a church like that can get its stuff together, any church can, perhaps. But this church has a lot of conflicts going on, and one of them, among many, was that they were divided over what leader should we follow. Both Paul and Apollos had been leaders in their church, and now people were like, "Well, I'm a Pauline Christian." And the other group was like, "Well, we're more Apollos Christians." And it cracks me up because you could substitute that for many words we use today as Christians. I'm a progressive Christian. I'm an evangelical Christian. I'm of the charismatic tradition. I'm Mennonite. I'm Catholic. Whatever. But what seems to be happening is that each faction, each side, they think of themselves as super spiritual. They're the enlightened ones, so they're speaking of the other camp as merely human. People who follow Paul, they're merely human. We Apollos people, we're enlightened, we're spiritual. And so Paul comes to them and says, "You want to play that game with merely human words? Let me tell you something. You're a bunch of juveniles. And the proof is in the pudding. Look at you. All you do is quarrel and strife. So you haven't learned yet what it really means to travel the Jesus path. You're just beginners, and it's showing. You have some learning to do." I like how N.T. Wright summarizes this. He says, "Imagine being the only musical person listening to a wonderful string quartet in a large room full of tone-deaf people. This is rather like Paul's picture of being a spiritual person in a world of merely human people." I like that. I mean, it's a very academic British analogy, right? Like a four-string quartet. Anyway, but the point remains, it's like imagine being trained in music and you're sitting in a room and nobody appreciates it and you're just like, "These tone-deaf people, get with the show. You haven't really understood the basics of Jesus' path." That's what Paul's saying. You have some learning to do. I think we see this all over the place. Two Christmases ago, because I learned my lesson, I decided to make my family on Christmas Day a beautiful meal. And I got some nice steaks, like filet mignon. It was delicious. Mushrooms, red wine reduction sauce. Like, I just, it's Christmas. I'm going to, And it was like throwing pearls to swine with my kids, right? I gave it to them, and I still remember we're eating Christmas Day, and who put ketchup on the table? I don't know. It wasn't me. But I remember Huxley pouring ketchup on his steak. And I was like, who are you? What are you doing? He's like, it tastes better this way. I'm like, oh, I can't even. You're not my son. Please. Jeez. I'm like, you're ruining it. You haven't developed the taste. You haven't developed the palate to appreciate that ketchup cheapens everything, essentially. Except for hot dogs. It works on hot dogs, but. And so that's what Paul's saying. He's like, you guys, you don't have a taste. You haven't developed a palate to fully understand the Jesus path. You're basically like somebody who thinks they're Chef Gordon Ramsay by putting ketchup on a nice meal. I mean, it's just, you're not who you think you are. So Paul's heartbroken. You're making a good thing a banner. And you're making a distinction part of your identity. And so what I have to say is good. What Apollos has to say is good. They're both gay. You know, they're both okay. And it's good. It's fine to like different teachers. But they don't have to be pitted against each other. And now that you've made a banner, all you've done is create enemies. The enemy-making machine. A distinction can start as a necessity, but very quickly can turn into the thing that creates us versus then. I think this is always what banners do. They become less about how we live, more about what makes us different than others. It becomes a slogan that we sort of throw around to sort of indicate who is in and who is out of a group. It starts, perhaps, as necessary, but ends up creating enemies. So one of the questions I've been thinking about this one is, can you have a banner? Can you have this banner make sense apart from describing who or what you are against? Can you have a banner, a distinction, without mentioning its opposite or another part? And I'll call out my own stink here first. But, you know, in starting Nexus, right, like trying to look for like a tagline, what defines us, right? And so for Nexus, I often describe it as a fresh expression of the Christian path. And the interesting thing to me about that is that fresh, right, of course, implies a counterpart. It's hard to define fresh without first defining rotten. And so even in our little slogans about church, it's like even something simple like that can come to sort of set us apart. Well, we're not that, that rotten thing. Progressive, evangelical, they do it all the time. Pro-life versus pro-choice, political parties, it becomes almost impossible to define yourself without mentioning what you're against. And so much of our language today just feels steeped in enemy terms, even if it's only subtle or implied. And it's hard because it's like, well, how do you even talk about issues? How do we even have a common language? And to be honest, I'm not really sure. It's a learning curve, but too often our banners frame people as enemies. And it's worth, I think, reminding all of us ourselves that Paul reminds us that there is an enemy, but it's not other people. He says in Ephesians 6, our struggle is not against flesh and blood. It's not against other humans. That's not the enemy. It's against rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. I think it's worth churches reminding ourselves other human beings are not the enemy. And what our banners, whether it's churches or outside, what they have the propensity to do is make enemies flesh and blood. That person, those people are the problem. And so often, the worst part is that it's a caricature of other people. I mean, this is what was happening in Corinth. They're like, these people are merely human. It was a complete caricature, and we do the same things today. Those people are so dumb. We're enlightened. They're so backwards. We're woke. Those people are snowflakes. We're enlightened. It's a caricature. And so I've come to think this, if a banner only makes sense by describing what's it against, then I think the call of every church is that needs to be deconstructed. because there's an enemy machine at work, and I don't know about you, but I'm just so tired of playing in it and having it influence over me. There's another telltale sign that the enemy machine is at work. We call it Schadenfreude. I don't know if that's good German or not. Pleasure at the misfortune of others. I think we know that the enemy-making machine is pumping when we sense within ourselves a touch of pleasure, right? Glee. When the other side experiences defeat or failure. It's those moments, right, where we kind of mutter underneath our breath or even just think, I knew it. I knew I was right. Man, that looks good on them. They had it coming. Glad I'm not one of them. I'll tell you, I forget if I asked you to make a slide of these. These three people, been convicted of this week. Mark Driscoll, James McDonald, Joshua Harris. Some of those names will be familiar to you, others maybe not. But in my day, Mark Driscoll was this neo-reform guy, right? Mr. Macho. And when he was exposed for buying his way onto the New York Times bestseller list. Like, I've been in arguments with the neo-reform people, and when he kind of went crashing down, I can't tell you how good that felt. Just like, I knew it. This is what your leaders do? Please. When James McDonald, huge church, these harvest churches, and when, geez, things got crazy with him, when they fell, it's like, I told you. You'd listen to me, your churches wouldn't be in disarray. Or Joshua Harris, he was the one who wrote the book, I Kiss Dating Goodbye. This was part of my upbringing or my late teen, early 20 life, mostly because I didn't adhere to the book and I got trouble from people. I remember going out on a date. Yada, yada, yada. There was a kiss at the end of the night, fairly harmless, but I remember I went and I told my buddies. They're like, what are you doing? We kissed dating goodbye. I said, you might have kissed dating goodbye. I didn't. I'm saying hello. I'm in my prime here. But they were so, what are you doing? That's not how we do things. And when he came out and was like, it was all a piece of garbage, I was like, yes. I just wanted to call them. Like, remember when you gave me heck? Yeah. Now your guy doesn't look so good, does he? I don't know. Am I the only petty one here? Because I feel this stuff all the time. This strange sense of vengeful satisfaction when we're proven right. I mean, it's like there's this sense of security when someone on the other side falls. Ah, now I feel more secure in my own beliefs. And for me, it was, if this is what your brand of Christianity looks like, if this is what happens to your leaders, well, I think we know I'm right. It feels good when the other side falls. And it has become so clear to me just how anti-Christ that is. It's wrong. And I become so convicted of it, this sense of superiority I get when the other side loses or fails. There's just no place for it on the Christian path. It's totally antithetical. And whenever we experience some kind of perverse enjoyment over the other side losing, anytime we get a sense of superiority over the other side, it's a telltale sign. Enemy-making machine is really at work. And I mean, Jesus had some strong things to say about this. Luke 11, to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, thank you, I'm not like the other people. Robbers, evildoers, adulterers, even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And Jesus said, I'll tell you, this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. I'll tell you, it is passages like this that keep me coming back to Jesus, because he cuts with a hot knife through the butter of our bullshit. Boom, you think you're so good and superior because you're under a banner, and he just cuts through it. You think you're mature, but you're juveniles. And I sense it in myself. Spiteful glee in me whenever the other side falters, whenever I think my side is superior. It's a sign that I'm not aware of perhaps how much my passions, my motivations have been shaped by an allegiance to a group. I think the Christian path cries up, wake up! Don't you see what the machine is doing to you? And so I ask myself, how do we break free from this machine? A few observations to close. First, I think it's about changing the nature of our questions. Because when we allow our identity to be determined by what we're against, I think it leaves us in fear and anger, right? And like Joshua last week, when we're in that mode, our predominant question becomes, are you on our side or are you for the enemy? But if we step back and realize God is on neither side, then the question shifts from what side are you on in this conflict to, what might God be doing in this conflict? Perhaps God is working not for a side, but within the middle of the conflict for something new to emerge, a space beyond enemies, new ground. I wrote this down one time. I can't remember for the life of me who said it, but I love it. It's this: conflict is something better trying to happen. And I believe it to be true, but I think what so often happens is most of us are tempted, before we ever get to that better thing, to just walk away, retreat to our side. I mean, I know this to be true on a level, even just personally in marriage, right? Like whenever Kristen and I fight over whatever it is, it's helpful to remind myself the reason we're fighting is we're both passionate about something and it's not working. And so something better needs to emerge. But what tends to happen is you get fighting, you get stuck in your ways, you put some defensive walls up. But it's like, no, conflict is something better wants to emerge here. And I'd like to believe that God is working in the middle of that. When we step back and realize God's not on either side, maybe God's at work right in the middle of that. And I think a good word to start when we think about entering that space beyond enemies is to start with these words from David Fitch. In looking at our enemies, we always learn more about ourselves than about who we fight against. I think there's some practical ways to look at this. When we think and do some soul searching around our enemies, what exactly about them is it that produces these feelings in me? Why do I experience disgust when I think about those people? Or envy, or even fear? Why do I feel so defensive? What does seeing that person shamed make me? Why does that make me feel so good? I think to even just start with those questions might make space for holy ground to emerge. And you know, usually in conflicts, I'm the one who needs to be reminded of some good questions to ask. But I remember very clearly, I was with my two brothers, and we Watsons have a propensity to fight. We get passionate about stuff. And usually I'm right in the middle of that, doing something, saying silly things, but I was kind of on the borderline. And my two brothers were fighting. It was getting to the point, right, where they were starting to go into that area where it's like, oh, I'm going to remember that comment tomorrow, because that was a little bit further than just arguing about an issue. It was starting to get personal. I remember my one brother was worked up, and I was in this space where I was just watching this, and I remember saying to him, what are you so afraid of? And he just stopped. It's like, that's a weird question. But given how angry I am right now, clearly I'm afraid of something. And this stuff doesn't happen to me often, but it just stopped the whole conflict with one question, reflecting about, wait a second, I'm really caught up in this thing. But being able to just pause and say, wait, let's get to the bottom of this. What am I afraid of here? What is it that's driving me to become so passionate? And in that moment, it was a beautiful thing. It was able to just calm the moment. And I want to look, I think next week, at Jesus' story with the woman caught in adultery, because I think there's some beautiful tactics Jesus is employing underneath that for conflict we'll look at. But the right questions can do a world of wonder in breaking the enemy-making machine. What is it about the enemy that makes me feel this way? Why am I angry? Why do I experience disgust when I think about them? Why am I afraid? Why am I so defensive? To do this, I believe, is to start creating that space of holy ground where God can work in the midst of our conflict.